Hello, this is the other side of paradise. I won't leave you in suspense any longer. Let's begin. As a second lieutenant in an increasingly fatal war, Scott was stationed at Camp Sheridan outside of Montgomery, Alabama, for training before going to France. Zelda was freshly graduated from high school, 18 years old, and still brimming with youth, stirred by the excitement of being a part of the home front of the war. Though Zelda had an inclination towards rebellion in high school, the opportunities afforded to her now created a new realm of freedom. Drinking, smoking, dancing, and men to kiss were all available for the girls of Montgomery. Dance halls hosted high-energy debauchery to boost the morale of men headed to the trenches, mud, and a startling reality of young death. We find Zelda in the thick of this. Still a talented ballerina, and now a volunteer, rolling bandages for the Red Cross, there was little else to do but boost morale. As a second lieutenant, Scott was nearer to the upper crust that he was striving towards. Instead of frequenting dance halls like enlisted men, he also had the invitation to sophisticated society parties and fundraisers, acting the part of a northern socialite like a certain old sport he ended up writing. Scott blended himself to the crowd that he wanted to be a part of. One night, carrying on this facade of a traditional Princeton man with money and consequence waiting for him in New York, Scott entered a party at a popular country club. Mingling with friends and the Montgomery social scene, his night was typical, until everyone gathered to watch the night's entertainment, a local ballerina. And that was the beginning of everything. Scott and Zelda's romance was quickly passionate, pulling her in with promises of life once he sold a novel in the allure of New York City. She was enthralled. She held Scott with the charms her southern upbringing had afforded her, juxtaposed with the rebelliousness that she could throw it all away. She was a debutante, a socialite, politically and socially well-connected, the wife the man he believed he would be one day should have. She later wrote, "Being in love," she concluded, "is simply the presentation of our past to another individual, mostly packages so unwieldy that we can no longer manage the loosened strings alone. Looking for love is like asking for a new point of departure," she thought, "another chance at life." Zelda Fitzgerald in Save Me the Waltz. Zelda and Scott would spend the time he was stationed in Alabama falling deeply in love. During this time, Scott submitted another novel to Scribner's. He received another rejection. But then, with the summer spent, October came around. Scott and his company were called back to the North in order to be sent to France. In desperation to cling to the good in his life, Scott proposed to Zelda. She said no. Scott was stationed in Camp Mills for just a blink of the universe before the armistice with Germany was signed. In a great stroke of luck, or perhaps the hand of fate, Scott was not only spared from war, but also sent back to Montgomery. Our lovers reunite here and begin to add a foundation for a relationship to the fleeting infatuation they possessed. They also began a time that Scott would later call sexual recklessness. By the time Christmas was approaching, Zelda and Scott had left infatuation far behind and had fallen deeply into real love. At this point, Zelda became more than his aspirational wife of his future self, but also his muse. Their conversations, relationships, and musings entered his work, as well as including Scott taking excerpts from Zelda's diary to bolster his prose. On Valentine's Day, 1919, Scott was discharged. He left the warmth of his lover and the South and began pulling his life together in New York City. The life he had promised Zelda, he was rejected from 7 newspapers he asked for a job from. So he went and sought his fortunes in advertising, securing a job and earning a salary. Scott was still poor, but was at least stable. He sent Zelda his mother's ring, and much to the dismay of her family, she accepted his proposal. Zelda's Episcopalian family looked down on the Catholic Scott and bolstered their protest by pointing out his outrageous drinking habits. Their fears became realized shortly as Scott, like his father, was unable to make it in New York. He returned to his family in St. Paul. Scott had only sold one short story in New York for $30 after being rejected over 120 times. Faced with the reality of what life with the man she loved would look like, Zelda broke their engagement and returned to Southern social circles and courtship. Scott was crushed, poor, and quickly turning out far more like his father than the man he promised Zelda and himself he would one day be. In St. Paul, he began revising The Romantic Egotist, a perhaps more truthful title for the novel that would become This Side of Paradise. This novel, a semi-autobiographical account of Scott's time at Princeton, exposes a theme that will later come to pass. In the dark underbelly of this gorgeous romance, this underdog story about achieving your dreams is an alcoholic with narcissistic tendencies. If this was a novel, we could have written this out. But I promised, in the beginning, this was real people with true complex lives. History is messier than a great American love story. Scott does have redeeming qualities. There are genuine reasons he captured the heart of the belle of the ball, one quality being he is determined and willing to work for his goal. Scott spent his time in St. Paul repairing car roofs for money as he reconstructed this side of paradise, working hard to encapsulate the new morality present in today's youth. Times were changing, and he wanted to weave it into a book worth reading. Eventually, he succeeded. Buoyed on the pages of This Side of Paradise, Scott soared into the life he envisioned for himself. On March 26, 1920, it was published. Rocketing to instant success, Scott had the buzz and now the income to become an illustrious author. For a third time, Scott proposed, and Zelda agreed. After the end of a war, a failed advertising career, and a novel success story, were married on April 3rd, 1920, in St. Patrick's Cathedral. This Side of Paradise sold 41,075 copies in its first year. The Fitzgeralds celebrated their marriage with raucous parties. Soon, they were celebrities, simply for their escapades in New York City. Society papers reported on what they did and wore, simply on the merit of who they were. Scott's career began to take a backseat to his life as a socialite. But the money was not endless, and they would soon begin the cycle they would live for the rest of their lives, spending the money they earned about as quickly as it entered their hands. This young couple, drunk on the light and absinthe in the midst of prohibition, had no idea what to expect from the future. This was not yet frightening, but exciting, especially since they were expecting. This is where we leave our young married lovers. If you were here for romance, I'm sorry, this is where the line ends for you. The future is both bright and bleak for our dear Fitzgeralds. And if you thought the road so far was rocky, be prepared for a climb.
Hello again, and welcome to the other side of paradise. Shall we begin? We left our lovers in New York City with a dwindling cash flow, celebrity status, and a baby on the way. Zelda found out that she was pregnant on Valentine's Day 1921, as Scott was working on his next novel, a badly needed bid for a cash infusion. He titled it The Beautiful and the Damned. Again, a very accurate title for the moment in their lives. Lacking the money to continue, and with the deadline of a due date quickly approaching, the Fitzgeralds decided to return to St. Paul and stay with Scott's family, so that he could focus and the baby would be delivered away from the chaos of the city. On October 26, 1921, Zelda gave birth. Delivering a child was quite a different matter in 1921. I'll spare you the gory details, but Zelda completed a twilight sleep. this procedure involved putting the mother on some sort of anesthesia and inducing labor, then possibly forcibly removing the baby. This was, as you might imagine, a dangerous practice for both the mother and the baby. However, both Zelda and her new baby girl emerged unscathed, though famously, Scott recorded Zelda's words as she emerged from anesthesia. "Oh God, Goofo, I'm drunk. Mark Twain, isn't he smart? She's the hiccups. Oh, I hope it's a beautiful and a fool. A beautiful little fool." If her words are familiar, you've read The Great Gatsby. Daisy Buchanan says these words almost exactly about her own daughter. Now, as we've already established, the naming of a child is no small matter. After all, we are dealing with two people whose names either coincidentally or fatefully perfectly fit them and the meanings behind the names. This is also a revealing moment for Scott's psyche. It is unclear what exactly Zelda had in mind for the name of her child, but it was likely not the name of her husband. This was quickly an overshadowing crowd into the joy of new parenthood. Scott wanted to name the child Francis Scott Fitzgerald, and understandably, Zelda did not. In the end, Scott won. The baby was named for her father, with only one letter of difference. Francis was spelled with an E rather than an I. Now it is impossible to posthumously diagnose Scott with any sort of mental disorder. However, his life and writing strongly suggest two possibilities. Firstly, that he struggled with some form of alcoholism, and secondly, some type of narcissistic personality disorder. There is overwhelming evidence that Scott struggled deeply with his relationship with alcohol. He was a notorious partier, so was Zelda for that matter, but he outdrank her at every turn and brought his issues home with him and into the rest of his life. Later in life, it would lead to a series of hospitalizations. It is unclear what exactly led to his eventual death, but years of heavy alcohol consumption surely had a role to play. There are many moments and actions that suggest Scott was unable to look past himself, his work, his reputation, and his legacy to truly care for the others around him as themselves rather than who they were to him. This accounts for his immediate charm and confidence, as well as the conflicts he famously had with his wife and friends, and then ultimately, the name of their daughter. Frances Scott Fitzgerald, the daughter, never ended up going by Frances, but instead was called by the nickname that her mother gave her for the rest of her life. Going forward, we will be referring to her by her preferred name, Scotty. We are now entering a slightly foggier age of the Fitzgeralds' lives. This era is fraught with confusion and speculations of scholars and historians. I will do my best to untangle what I can for you, or at the very least, give you the evidence and the theory. After Scotty's birth, the Fitzgeralds returned to New York, and Scott continued to push forward on The Beautiful and the Damned. Then, once again, Zelda found herself pregnant. Here's where the story becomes convoluted. The Fitzgeralds did not have a second baby. There were rumors at one point of an entry in Scott's diary that referenced Zelda and her abortionist. But no such diary entry has been found. There is also a chapter in The Beautiful and the Damned that is lent to this rumor. The main character, Gloria, brings concerns to her lover that she's pregnant. And he says, "Talk to some woman and find out what's best to be done. Most of them fix it some way." Though this section was removed from the final version, it seems abortion would have been too controversial at the time and would have overshadowed the plot point. Regardless of abortion or miscarriage or perhaps simply being incorrect about the pregnancy, no baby was born. Scotty would forever remain the sole heir to the Fitzgerald legacy. Later that year, Scott published The Beautiful and the Damned and experienced moderate success. By the end of the year, 50,000 copies had been sold. Scott also published a series of 11 short stories titled Tales of the Jazz Age. Though there is not one source to point at where the name coming from the Jazz Age is, It is widely considered that this title has a large part to play in it. These works provided a crucial cash infusion to the family, and they quickly took it in stride. Once again reclaiming their celebrity status, the Fitzgeralds took full advantage of Prohibition, which had started in January of 1920. They were removed from both the Biltmore and Commodore hotels for drunkenness. Zelda once gave an impromptu and wobbly ballet performance in the fountain at Union Square. They were famously drunk and chaotic in almost a charming way, arriving to parties only to quickly fall asleep for a nap and then finish the night dancing erratically. Dorothy Parker, a rising satirist and poet at the time, met the Fitzgeralds when they were perched atop a taxi cab. She later said, "They did look as though they both had just stepped out of the sun. Their youth was striking. Everyone wanted to meet him." This is why the Fitzgeralds are so impossibly towering figures of the 1920s. They act as if they are the main characters of the story. But the story is a decade of a population. They cannot be everyone's main character. They're glowing, bright, chaotic, and demand your attention. But they are also broken, drunk, and tragic. People are tangled strands of traits, and the Fitzgeralds are no exception. Everyone believes that they are the main character of their own story, but the Fitzgeralds seem to believe they were the main characters of everyone else's story. While their celebrity status grew, they were the shining figure of society. Their home life was rapidly deteriorating. Financial troubles, drunkenness, and jealousy, both relational and somewhat professional, seeped in between the cracks of their greatness to erode at their chance for happiness. This became exacerbated as Scott was no longer satisfied with his literary work and instead turned to the theater. He developed a screenplay and produced a play titled The Vegetable, Out of Pocket. To put it kindly, Scott's investment did not pay off. In 1923, his play had an incredibly short run, at a loss to him and his investors. He was running low on money, with a toddler and a wife that he was increasingly at odds with. In a desperate bid to reclaim a healthy home life and stimulate his creativity, thus his cash flow, Scott moved his family to France so that he could complete his novel on the impossibility of the American dream.